Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at cparmetro.org or cindysheehansoapbox.com. I changed it up a little bit there, didn't I? Anyway, my guest today is my friend from Toronto, Keith Bolander. Keith and I work in the Cuban Solidarity Movement. Keith also worked for many years on the Toronto Star, and he currently lectures at the University of Toronto School of Continuing Studies on American Foreign Policy and the Cuba Revolution. Today he will be on the show talking about his newest book, Cuba Under Siege. Keith Bolander, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you very much, Cindy.
Oh, it's nice to talk to you. I actually was able to spend some time with you exactly a year ago right now when we did a conference in Toronto. I think it was, what was it called, the People's Tribunal for the Cuban Five?
Yes, that's it, exactly. It was held in Toronto. There was a number of people involved in the Cuban Five issue, and It was great to have you up in Toronto.
I stayed with you and your wife, Magali, and she actually is from Cuba.
Yep, that's correct.
So you have had a long association with Cuba?
Yeah, I've been connected with Cuba on and off for a variety of different projects since the late 1980s, just before the Soviet Union fell. So I saw a taste of Cuba before their special period, and then I got deeply involved with Cuba in the tourist industry as well as other aspects. In the last 7-8 years, my background's journalism, and I've been connecting with Cuba, writing books about Cuba.
Tell my listeners a little bit about the special period and what brought that on, and how did Cuba get out of that? I know, I've talked to Cubans, I've been there, I know about it, but maybe some of my listeners don't.
Well, for the first number of decades, Cuba, after the revolution, was connected with the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc, economically and socially. And then in 1989, the Soviet Union collapsed, and with it, more than 80% of all of Cuba's trade with the Soviet Union and the Eastern Socialist Bloc ended as well. So you can imagine the economic devastation that put Cuba under. They lost like 40% of their gross national product overnight. So it plunged them into their Great Depression. From the period of 1990 to 1994, they went through the absolute worst economic time since the revolution began. There was all sorts of blackouts in Havana. There was no gasoline for buses, public transportation ground to a halt. People were under extreme economic pressure, and at that time, the American, the U.S. policy was to make things worse, so they
right.
A few laws to try and even make things worse for the Cubans to finally convince the Cubans to rise up and get rid of their government. Well, it didn't happen. The Cuban government reached out to the rest of the world, started the international trading, expanding that. They also developed their tourist industry, which helped a great deal bring much-needed hard currency into the country. And it was those two elements, the expansion of the international trade and the development of the tourist industry, that really helped them get over the worst aspects of the special period. I mean, they're still seeing some effect of it, and the American embargo and the American aggression is still as strong as ever. So the Cubans are still dealing with a lot of economic problems that other countries don't deal with.
Well, during the special period, wasn't that when Bill Clinton, like you said, put additional sanctions against Cuba and against anybody who actually traded with Cuba?
Yeah, the whole point was when Cuba lost its trade with the Soviet Union, the American strategy was, well, we're going to prevent them from trading with the rest of the world. And during the mid-90s, under the Clinton administration, there was two laws passed, the Torricelli Act and the Helms-Burton Act, and both of them basically were designed to strengthen the economic embargo. It prohibited American subsidies based in other countries, including Canada, from trading with Cuba. So as Cuba tried to expand its international trade, the Americans were trying to diminish it. And they were quite successful. Very few American subsidies continued trading with Cuba. And then there were other laws preventing ships that had docked in Cuba for trading purposes to enter any U.S. port for 6 months. They expanded the ability for Cuban Americans to sue the Cuban government under the controversial confiscated lands. So there was all sorts of elements that made things worse for the Cuban government to try and recover from their special period. So the Americans' attempt was to finally destroy the revolution through increased economic sanctions, and fortunately it didn't work.
Today we're talking about your new book called Cuba Under Siege, and what I thought interesting about it was that you kind of compare it with the siege mentality that the U.S. has had since September 11th. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. The book, the concept of the book was to sort of explain how American policy of aggression, not just their economic embargo, but everything else, all the other aspects of America foreign policy aggression against Cuba, has affected Cuban society. One of the things that Cuba gets criticized for is their civil rights restrictions, that they have surveillance systems to make sure that the population isn't involving itself in activities that are against the government. And we've seen the same thing happen in the United States, not just since 9/11, but historically when the American government has felt itself under national security threat, or in a wartime situation where civil rights have been restricted. You look at the NSA programs, the surveillance, the extensive surveillance that's going on in the United States after 9/11. So societies are affected when they feel threatened. And Cuba, since the revolution in 1959, has had nothing but American aggression and American hostility. So there's this small little Caribbean island up against the world's greatest superpower, and America has always had as a strategy regime change against the government, against the revolutionary government. So it's had an impact. It's had a negative effect on Cuban society, the economy, obviously, the culture, the individual, in this creation of a siege mentality that the government has had to develop to protect itself and its citizens. So the book sort of explains that and examines that from an individual level, from a policy level, and it puts it in context of what American society is going through right now under 9/11, which is even, as we're getting more and more information about how much America, the individual American, is under surveillance and how many civil rights are being restricted on the United States under the guise of 9/11, you can understand what the Cuban government was going through, only so much more impactful, because you're talking the world's greatest power trying to destroy the small little country.
What do you make of, this is a little bit off the subject, but what do you make, but not really, because I was just in Havana last week, and I went to the bunkers and the tunnels and the footprints of where the big cannons were during the, the missile, what's that called? The missile crisis, thank you. And what do you make of what recently happened internationally with Putin and Russia actually, like, stopping Obama in the United States from bombing another country? Do you think that that old Cold War balance of power is being restored a little bit?
Well, I think it's a good sign. I think it's an excellent sign, regardless of the reason, whether it's a post-war syndrome after Iraq and Afghanistan or whatever the reason. It's great to see the Americans looking for diplomatic resolution instead of using violence as their first option, although Obama first said, well, we're going to bomb Syria. That was his first option, and then it was the international community and national public pressure that changed that attitude, and it looks like there's going to be a diplomatic solution, which is great. I think it's a very positive sign for everyone concerned, wherever you're living, And Cuba certainly supported the diplomatic resolution simply because they've had 50 years of being under the gun of American aggression, including an actual military invasion in 1961 at the Bay of Pigs.
Right.
And then the whole Cuban Missile Crisis was predicated on the fact that the Cubans were convinced the Americans were going to invade again, only not just with exiles, but with the full force of the American military, and that led them to install the nuclear weapons in Cuba as a defensive reaction towards what they were totally convinced was going to be a full-scale American invasion in early 1963.
Well, and you talked about the siege mentality that's happening in the United States, especially since 9/11, but of course there are pre-9/11 instances of it. But not only have we seen the police state rising and the incidences of, you know, surveillance on citizens and an increasing violence of even just police forces against citizens here down in the United States, we also are undergoing an economic, troubles, and it seems like they aren't getting any better. All the indicators are getting worse. And what kind of implications do you think that this might have for, an easing of the embargo against Cuba? And to me, it's just an asinine, thing that the United States is keeping up, because we have, full trade with Vietnam and China now, and we still have this asinine embargo against Cuba. So do you think that the problems in the States are going to get so bad that, just it's going to be like an easing of restrictions by default?
Yeah, it's an interesting concept. I hope you're right, but historically I don't have a lot of expectation on that, because Cuba is so unique. I mean, the Americans, like you said, have full trading relations, most favored trading relations with Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone knows all the trading relations they have with China, so what's the problem with Cuba? What makes Cuba different is that the American political elite does not consider Cuba as an international problem. They consider it as a domestic problem, and that goes back to the history of the two countries when America dominated Cuba for 60 years prior to the revolution, and the whole strategy of regime change is to get back what they lost from the revolutionaries. So it makes no sense whatsoever on any level why the Americans continue the embargo, which prohibits trade with Cuba and also prohibits Cuba from exporting any of their goods into the United States. But Cuba isn't, in my opinion, you can't look at Cuba rationally, because there's the whole history behind it, there's the whole emotional aspect of the sense of loss and resentment, and the Americans just haven't gotten over that, and the policy continues from the first generation exiles who left Cuba, who maintained their hatred against Fidel and the revolution, and that's supported by American strategy of regime change. So it just, there's so much forces in favor of normalizing relations, including the huge agricultural industry in the States, the Chamber of Commerce in the United States, but there's still this block that the Americans can't get over, forgiving the revolution and Fidel for what he did to them. So, economically it makes perfect sense to access a market of 11 million people for both sides, but it's just hopefully, the economic problems in the States will push the change in the policy and bring normalization to Cuba. But boy, after 60 years, it's hard to imagine it.
Well, in your book, you talk voices of the powerful and voices of the common person, and I want to talk about some one thing that I've never really been able to do because of my language barrier is talk to the common Cuban. I've always had relationships with people that are in activism and the government and things like that, so I've had a lot of a lot of, communication with them, but not just the average Cuban on the street. And, you know, that's my fault, you know, with my language barrier. But have you spoken, I want to talk about those people that you speak to in Cuba, but have you spoken to, like, Cubans in Miami, the counter-revolutionaries, about their views about what's still going on, about the embargo, about the revolution? Do you have any connection with them?
Yeah, it's interesting. The demographics in Miami are changing when it comes to Cuban-American immigrants, because the first generation who left 50, 60 years ago, right after the revolution, they were the ones who lost everything, the land, the political power, the economic influence. Now you're finding the Cubans who are immigrating to America have a different attitude. They lived under the revolution. They've seen the social benefit programs. They've seen the shortcomings. But they've lived all their lives under the revolution, and they want to maintain contact with their family and friends, and that more than anything, I think, is the energy that's going to change and force normalization, where they start voting for Cuban American politicians who favor normalization, who favor engagement. So yeah, I've talked to a number of them in Miami. There's organizations. There's actually very influential organizations that are coming out of Miami in favor of normalization and in favor of ending the embargo. And you're going to see them grow politically in strength, and you're going to see them grow economically in influence as well. And so as the older generation, the first generation, dies off, the new generation takes over, they're the ones who are going to start driving policy towards Cuba, and hopefully that will be the solution to the normalization. But yeah, the book contains a lot of interviews with high-level officials, but I like talking to the average Cuban to get their opinion in Cuba, outside of Cuba, because their voices are the ones that are going to make the most difference in the near future.
Okay, so I do want to hear about what they are saying, but I have a question before we get on to that. How do you think that normalization of trade and diplomatic relations with Cuba normalization, I can see how it will affect Cuba positively, but do you think that there will be negative effects of that?
Well, I get that question a lot, and there's a lot of people who have been involved with supporting Cuba for years who express some sort of concern that if normalization takes place, that it'll change Cuban culture and will change the structure of the revolution in a negative way. And my answer is, well, let the embargo end, let the travel restrictions, which are even more important, let them end so average American tourists and whoever can go down to Cuba and see for themselves. Let them interact with the average Cubans. Let them see the good, the bad. And let Cuba, the government, solve the problems of having 1 million Americans a year coming down or having normal trade with the United States. I have full confidence in the Cuban government that they'll sort things out. They'll evolve as they're doing now with the economic reforms. It's a win-win for both sides, and I don't agree with those who say, well, if the normalization took place, it'll have a negative impact on Cuba. Well, it's having a tremendous negative impact on Cuba with the embargo in place, so let's end the embargo, let's end the travel restrictions, and let Cuba sort out what the effects are going to be. Let them deal with whatever problems or whatever influences are going to take place. But regardless, it will be such a positive thing, if the travel restrictions were ended, the embargo was lifted, the terrorism was stopped, the propaganda was ended, and the two countries had normal relations.
Well, and when I came back last time, I came back through customs in Los Angeles, and I just thought that I was in Cuba. I flew through Panama. I could have said I was just in Panama, but I just said Cuba because I think it's better to tell the truth than to lie. And the immigration agent, he looked at me and goes, are we allowed to go to Cuba now? And I said, well, I guess so, because I just went there.
This is an immigration official who doesn't know the law.
Exactly. So
it's so ridiculous. The Cubans have ended so many of their bureaucratic measures for the Cuban citizens to travel, but the United States of America still has this incredible restriction for normal American citizens to go to Cuba. Unless you're Cuban American, you can travel to Cuba back and forth without any restrictions, or unless you go through these organized people-to-people programs. But it's ridiculous to have the travel restrictions for an average American, because you're right. Most Americans don't even know there are still restrictions to travel to Cuba.
Right. I mean, like I said, even the immigration officials. So, Keith Bolander, what do you hear from just the average Cuban? You're married to, I think she's above average, your wife, but... You know, what do you hear? I do talk to Cubans, of course, around the world who are sympathetic to the revolution, because that's just the circle that I travel in. But what do you hear from your contacts?
Well, like any country, any place you visit, you'll get a wide variety of opinions. You'll get people in Cuba that are 100% supportive of the revolution still, and you get people in Cuba that are much less supportive. But the general feedback I get, the general sense I get from Cubans, the average Cuban in Cuba, is that they support the major economic changes, the reforms that are taking place. They want them to go a little quicker, but that's a condition of siege, too. The Cuban government is going to take these reforms very slowly because they don't want to give the American government any opportunity to exploit them. And so there is a general sense of change in Cuba in a positive way, still maintaining the revolutionary social programs, the successes of the revolution, the health care, the education, the sense of community that you find so strong in all parts of Cuba. There's always a sense, you know, there's always people who will complain and not agree with what the Cuban government does. But in general, I see a very positive attitude, and there's a lot of hope for the future. They still have tremendous problems to overcome economically, but they're moving in a direction that I think is much more supportive now than it was even 5 or 6 years ago, and that's just due to the substantial number of reforms that are taking place under Raul.
Well, and I was just in Cuba maybe 2 years ago, and then I returned, like I said, last week, and just coming, you know, going from the airport to Havana, I saw probably about 10 new restaurants that weren't there before. Just, you know, small little restaurants there. I started going to Cuba first in 2000 and the beginning of 2007. And the improvement in access to internet is still very frustrating for a spoiled person like me, but it's like light years ahead of where it was just like 6 years ago. But like they told me, we're trying to get our internet capability up to speed without using you know, these profiteers, by doing it the Cuban way.
Yeah, very much so, and that's a good example. I mean, the American propaganda machine, you know, criticizes Cuba for not giving access to the internet to the individuals that they say the government controls it. It's not the case at all. The government didn't have access. There was fiber optic cables going right off the coast of Cuba that were controlled by the United States, and they weren't allowed access to them. So for years, the Cubans had to use the old satellite, which is tremendously limiting. Well, now they are getting access to the higher technology programs, and the Cuban government is doing it their way. They're expanding the internet access, and that's a huge change. That's one of many, many changes that have taken place in Cuba over the last year or two, and you see so many not only restaurants, there's more taxis on the streets, there's more involved, the change in the laws for the homes and the cars. There's all sorts of things happening, so Cuba is changing quite rapidly. The only place that isn't changing, the only place that is completely stagnant, and I mentioned this in the last chapter of the book, is American policy against Cuba. They just absolutely refuse to understand the reforms taking place and recognize them and encourage them. It's very frustrating.
one thing that I super admire about Cuba and Cubans is that it's not a disposable society. You know, they never throw anything away. You know, they reuse, they repurpose, they refashion. They, you know, just do wonderful things because they have a limited access to consumer goods and things like that. But also, people aren't disposable there. You talked about their incredible sense of community. They're always in the town squares and in the streets and along the Malecón. You know, they're always out with each other in Cuba. They're not confined to their little homes watching TV.
And they will welcome you into their home and share with you whatever they have, regardless of the quantity or the quality, and are genuinely pleased to talk to you. And I have a lot of Cuban friends in Toronto that, our circle of friends, and I've never had to repair anything in my house because we always know one Cuban who can fix something about the house or something about the car. You know, they're absolutely incredible as far as their ability, as you say, a non-disposable society, because they've had the skills and the ability to fix and repair just about anything. It's quite remarkable compared to what our society is. If it's old or not even broken, we just throw it out and get a new one.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm just going to Cuba has made me a better human being, I think, along those lines. But Keith, tell my listeners how they can get more information about your book.
Well, it's called Cuba Under Siege: American Policy, the Revolution, and Its People. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. You can go on the Palgrave site. It's sold through Amazon. You can go to bookstores. If it's not in the bookstores, you can ask for it. It's available, through the Internet connection. And just to plug my first book, the first book I did was called Voices from the Other Side, and it was an oral history of terrorism against Cuba, where I interviewed dozens of individual Cubans who were victimized by the unknown war of terrorism against Cuba, and that was published 3 years ago by Pluto Press in London, England. But if anyone just goes on Google and Googles my name, or goes on to Amazon and Googles my name, they'll be able to access both books.
Well, briefly, talk about the terrorism that Cuba has had to face for decades. A lot of people, the United States have no idea about that.
Yeah, I would. The vast, vast majority. It's the great unknown war of terrorism that is just totally just not talked about in the United States. The media, the politicians, no one knows about it. And the first book was based on a series of interviews with individual Cubans. I did not talk to officials. I did not talk to politicians. I talked to average Cubans who were victims of these acts of terrorism. And the Cuban government has documented more than 600 acts that have killed over 3,500 Cuban civilians inside of Cuba. There were other acts of terrorism against Cuban targets in the United States, Miami, New York, as well as in Canada, Montreal, Toronto, and other places. But this book is based entirely on the acts against Cuban civilians, including attacks against Cuban teachers who were murdered for teaching adults to read and write, attacks on villages, biological terrorism. Dengue 2 was introduced. It killed 100 children. There were tourist facilities, hotels, and restaurants bombed, as well as the act of terrorism against the Cubana Airlines flight in 1976. The airplane was bombed, and 72 people were killed. And the two terrorists, the two masterminds of this act, one of them is still living in the United States in Miami, and there's been no attempt from the American government to bring this man to justice, Luis Posada Carriles. So the book sort of covers the different acts of the different types of terrorism that the Cubans have had to suffer, and how that has had an impact on society as well. So that's just one of the aspects of American aggression that has created this siege mentality that Cuban governments had to protect themselves against the terrorism, including sending sending agents to South Florida who were subsequently arrested and are still serving long prison terms for trying to prevent acts of terrorism. I'm sure you're familiar, and many are, with the situation of the Cuban Five, and that directly stems from this history of terrorism that so few people know about.
And we do cover the Five a lot on my show, so I'm sure my listeners are pretty well familiar with that case too. But I did get to meet Renee when I was in Havana, which was really cool.
Yeah, that's great to see him there and safe and recovering, and hopefully the other four will soon be released too.
I hope so too. Well, Keith Bollender, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and I hope to talk to you sooner than a year.
Cindy, you call me anytime. I very much thank you and appreciate the opportunity you gave me, and I hope to not only talk to you, but I hope to see you soon, too.
Okay, awesome. Say hi to the family.
Will do. Thanks a lot, Cindy.
Well, that's the Soapbox for today, for this week. I hope you learned something, and I hope you were inspired to take further action. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, and he's also my contact with Community Progressive Radio. I'd like to thank Keith for being my guest today. And as always, and most of all, I'd like to thank you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Peace out for now.